720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Happy New Year to you. Hoping that you all had a wonderful, lovely celebration ringing in the new year and wishing you a wonderful year ahead. We have lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We are going to be talking about the princess business. That's right, the big business of all those sparkly pink and purple things and how that might be changing a little bit and looking a little bit different in the year ahead. We're also going to be taking a look at big pharmaceutical. As we all know, that has been in the news a lot lately with Martin Shkreli, a name you can't say three times fast, but it's been in the news a lot lately, and it's kind of revealing a lot about that industry. So we're going to take a look at that. But right now, we are joined by our friend Zach Greenberg. He is the entertainment reporter at Forbes. Hi, Zach. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Well, you have written this really great piece about, you know, all the music predictions, all the things we can expect to see in the year ahead with the music industry. And it's so wonderfully timed because I think that is becoming quickly becoming an issue that's more in the mainstream focus, whereas I think it's been on people inside the industry. It's been on their minds for a little while, but particularly as we're looking at who's streaming, who's not streaming, what's happening to concert ticket prices, things like that, how artists are kind of strategically playing that that field and withholding streaming, things like that. I think that's a big, big, big piece of it that we're going to see making a lot of headlines in the year ahead.
Totally. You know, and I think that we're in a time in the music business where the average consumer now really does care and get involved with not just the music, but how the music is consumed, what the medium is. You know, if we're talking 15 years ago, there's not really any debate. You know, you're going to go out, you're going to get a CD. It's not very controversial. You're mainly talking about the music. But now, you know, the question is, you know, are you on Spotify? Are you on Tidal? Are you on Apple Music? Do you not like streaming at all? Would you rather own your own music? And, you know, now the artists, of course, feel like they have to have a say. So, you know, you hear Taylor Swift talking about, you know, what would require her to, you know, what her requirements would be to get onto Apple Music or Spotify or whatever it is. I think it's become a much more acceptable thing for artists to be involved in business. Before, it was kind of a, you know, like a dirty word almost, mm-hmm. that they didn't want to be seen as selling out or money grubbing. But I think that's true to some extent now, but I think it's also, you know, artists are looked upon positively if they're smart about, you know, what they're doing with their business. I think that leads into one of my first predictions of the year, which is that, you know, we're going to start to see kind of a stratification of musical audiences. So, you know, to be sure, in the past, you have your bands that are more expensive to see live, you know, U2, Rolling Stones, you're going to have to shell out a couple hundred bucks a pop. But, you know, it wasn't like you would have to pay more for a U2 CD than a Rolling Stones CD. You go to the store and it's, you know, $12.99 or it's $17.99. It depends more on the store than the artist. But, you know, now we have acts like Taylor Swift and Adele choosing not to let their music onto the free streaming services. And, you know, kind of requiring fans to go out and pay that $9.99 or $12.99 or whatever it is to get the digital download or to go out and buy the record, you know, physical. And, you know, suddenly it's like, well, you know, I'm paying my $9.99 a month for Spotify or Apple Music or whatever it is. If I'm a Taylor Swift fan or an Adele fan, you know, I'm now doubling my monthly allotment of what I'm having to spend on recorded music. And, you know, I almost wonder if there's going to become some kind of sort of class system of music fans where, you know, I mean, if you're a student or something and you're like, well, you know, I like Adele's music, but I just can't really afford it, you know, I think that's going to be one of the big issues that we start to see going forward, certainly coupled with the live music issue where tickets just keep going up and up and up. And particularly for acts like Taylor Swift and Adele, you know, I don't see that slowing down anytime soon.
Right, definitely not. Well, don't you think if we get into this, as you say, a kind of a class system of streaming music where there's a premium tier model where to get to some artists' work, I know it's a big topic right now among artists to think about, well, just because my work is really successful on, say, Spotify and I've gotten all these you know, all these plays of it, what the paycheck is for that artist is really just not livable. And I know that's a big topic where I think a lot of artists are starting to try to think that through and think that out. Like, and short of being Taylor Swift, I think it's still very difficult to make a living in the music industry. But, you know, as we kind of think through that, if, say, the example you used, a student who maybe can only afford the 10 bucks a month, but really wants that Taylor Swift album, do you think that will kind of bring a resurgence of what we saw from Napster and that kind of thing several years ago when this first when this disruption first kind of hit, where people were pirating a lot more music?
I think it could, but, you know, right now where people go when they want totally free music is YouTube. And, you know, obviously YouTube wasn't designed to be a music streaming service, but you go on YouTube, you can find anything by any artist. And, you know, by the way, Taylor Swift stuff is all up there under the Vivo kind of side of things. And, you know, so I think we have to go kind of more hunt and peck. It's not the greatest experience if you want to listen to music, if you want to, you know, sit and work and have an album on in the background, you know, going to YouTube and picking song by song and going through the ads and the free version and all that is not necessarily the greatest experience. But I think that's maybe where the fan would go in lieu of illegal. Although, you know, you never know. That's also something that still kind of pokes its head up and has not been totally eradicated. But I think it just became so much easier, to use Spotify or, services like that. That people felt, you know, well, why should I bother? Why should I bother with the pirating? But I think that's, if the user experience becomes too unpleasant or too costly, you know, perhaps we see a return to that kind of a thing.
Right. People will get creative. Well, another story that we saw kind of earlier this past year that will be interesting to follow that you've mentioned in your piece on Forbes is that about Jay-Z and Tidal, because I think that was such a big deal for a minute, and then it kind of got very quiet after he made that acquisition and launched.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, I wrote a book about Jay-Z called Empire State of Mind that kind of takes you through his whole, street corner to corner office kind of trajectory. And the Tidal move was sort of a classic Jay-Z move that I've studied him do numerous times. And he, he'll go for the Reebok instead of the Nike. He'll go for the Pepsi instead of the Coke, the sort of the challenger, the underdog, the Nets instead of the Knicks. And he'll associate himself with that brand because there's sort of more room to grow with it, right? He has more to be able to bring to the table when he's trying to help out an underdog or to buy an underdog and to bring it up a level. And that's what he did with Tidal. You know, it was a company that was already established, I think a few hundred thousand subscribers. And, you know, he kind of took it over, you know, rebranded it and rolled it out with this team of sort of musical superheroes. I think the idea behind it was great, which is that, you know, hey, we the musicians are gonna own this service and it's gonna cost the consumer the same amount of money, but, you know, the money will be going to the musicians. I mean, I think the thing that they got wrong was, you know, they picked like the 13 or 15 wealthiest musicians out there to be part of it. And, you know, surprise, nobody really feels more inclined to enrich Jay-Z or Madonna than they do, Tim Cook or whoever, Daniel Ek at Spotify. And, and I think that the big tone deaf problem there was that they didn't really explain how, you know, the average artist is going to benefit from it, right? From Tidal as opposed to one of the other services. But, you know, it's a huge issue in the music industry when you think about the big streaming services. The record labels actually own huge stakes in Spotify and these other companies because that was part of the negotiations to get to use the catalog. So these companies, you know, have equity in the streaming services, but the artists whose work is used on them don't get anything. And I think Tidal had a great opportunity to kind of distribute things more equitably. And instead it just kind of came off like the rich getting richer, and they happen to be musicians as well.
Right.
But, you know, here we have Jay-Z. He paid $56 million for this company, and now he's in kind of a bind where, you know, Apple and Spotify are much more well-funded, more adoption. What's he going to do? You know, Jay-Z has a way of kind of, you know, seeming like things are not going to turn out too well, and then all of a sudden, you know, he gets this amazing deal. Mm-hmm. It happened last year with Robinson Cano, who he was representing. Looked like he wasn't going to get a good deal, then got this, you know, massive contract that nobody expected. So I kind of think that Jay-Z is going to sell Tidal to perhaps, you know, Apple or Spotify. Probably Apple will be a more likely target for more than he paid for it. And he paid $56 million, so that's not you know, that's not much for a company like Apple to come in and kind of get rid of the nuisance and bring on some big personalities to help push Apple Music.
I feel like that kind of money is in the seat cushions in the break room at Apple, right? That's nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's no big deal at all. You know, and we're about out of time, but I also want to touch on another thing on your list, and that is we talk a lot about the gender pay gap, and it seems like there are two ladies on that list, and that's Rihanna and Taylor Swift with very big paychecks, and it seems like they might be in a bit of competition this year.
Yeah, you know, I think that Rihanna, Taylor Swift, Adele, you know, they're all going to have massive, massive years. Rihanna was actually down a bit last year. She was at $26 million. You know, for her, that's not a huge year. Taylor Swift was at $80 million. I would expect both of them to at least double those totals. Rihanna's going to tour a bunch. Taylor Swift, I think, will continue touring in the new year. And she's just been kind of on this unstoppable run for over a year now. It seems like she's got a new single out every couple months. So, I expect the momentum to keep going for both of them for sure.
Indeed. All right. You can check this article out and all the other stuff. It's by Zach Greenberg. He's the entertainment reporter at Forbes. And check out his book. It's called Empire State of Mind. It's a book all about Jay-Z. Thanks so much for being with us today, Zach.
Thank you.
Have a good one. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're talking about the princess industry. Oh, yeah, big bucks on that one. And it might be changing up a little bit. So stick around. We'll be right back on 720 WGN. Hi, it's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We've got lots to get to the rest of the show. Lots of big topics, including we're going to be talking about big pharmaceutical, because that is an industry we have gotten a really up close and personal look at lately as Martin Shkreli has been in the news more and more, the story we can't seem to look away from. But right now, joining us on the phone, we have Claire Sudduth. She is a writer at Bloomberg. Hi, Claire. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you have this wonderful piece on Bloomberg.com that is so interesting about the $500 million battle over Disney's princesses. And I think we all know that the princess business is very big business because we see sparkly things all over the place. I don't think we can go into any store lately without seeing princess something. But apparently the princess industry is kind of changing hands a little bit. And so we might expect to see some changes. Talk to us a bit about that, Claire.
Yeah, so you might not think this, but the princess brand is actually Disney's second most lucrative brand after Mickey Mouse. It accounts for about $5.5 billion. And it's been going gangbusters since about 2001 when they sort of launched the brand and they grouped all the princesses from the movies together. But they sort of decided that it wasn't playing so well with people anymore. There had been a bit of cultural pushback of parents thinking that, you know, what is the princess saying to my daughter? Why are they all lumped together? They don't seem to have personalities. Everything is just about sparkles and shoes. So Disney is sort of rethinking that and trying to reimagine the princesses as their own separate characters. They like to refer to them as being empowered. So when they have Frozen, the movie came out, it ends with the princess doesn't end up with a prince. Then there was Brave before that, where she can do archery and fights and that sort of thing. But with the older princesses, they can't really change the story, so they have to reimagine what they are like in terms of the toys. So they used to be made by Mattel, and now they're going to be made by Hasbro, and I'll get into why in a second. But Hasbro had to sort of reconfigure the dolls. They're making them different heights and sizes. They changed their faces so they look a bit more like the animated characters that they used to be rather than simply sort of dressed up Barbie dolls. Mm-hmm. And they're going to sort of market them in the future as individual women with individual stories and personalities and characteristics.
It's very interesting because I too have seen a lot of that pushback. I've talked a lot about that pushback here on the station, even about how these dolls, aimed at quite young ladies, were very sexual. They had very big boobs and tiny waists, and I think one of the dolls, her waist was smaller than her head, and it was just some very unreasonable standards. There was both body standard and then that kind of, as you point out, the narrative with some of the older princesses that all only found happiness once the prince showed up, of course, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I talked to a lot of parents, mothers specifically, for this article, and they felt really conflicted because when your 3-year-old daughter, you know, falls in love with a princess movie and wants to be Ariel or Belle or something like that, and you feel uneasy about it, but you don't necessarily know why. A lot of mothers said, well, you know, I don't know why she wants to dress up like this, but she does, so I'll buy it for her anyway, but I feel, you know, not quite right about this. So Disney is really trying to take away that uneasiness feeling and make them feel like, you know, my daughter can dress up like these characters because they are full people.
Right, right. You don't want to necessarily discourage imagination or creativity or playtime, but indeed there are some, you know, I think there's some socialization that a lot of parents fight and are resistant to, and with good reason. And so as we talk about this franchise, the big princess business, because it's bigger than just dolls and toys. I mean, we're talking about Glidden makes a paint line of these very pink and purple things. There's shoes with sparkles. It's on so many things. I mean, even in like a drugstore, there's combs and barrettes, and there's so many lip balm and all these things that are like covered in princesses and sparkles and all of this stuff. And it's such a, I mean, that's really, that price tag is no small amount. How really did Mattel, you know, this Mattel to Hasbro shift happen?
Well, so what's interesting is Mattel has had a very close relationship with Disney since 1955. It was the first sponsor of the original Mickey Mouse Club, and they have been their go-to doll maker for years and years. And so all of these Disney princess dolls have been made by Mattel before, who, you know, Mattel makes Barbie, which is still the best-selling doll of all time. And Hasbro traditionally, like going back about 10 years, did not make very many toys marketed to girls. They are known mostly for Transformers, G.I. Joe, they have Nerf, Monopoly. They have a lot of board games because they bought Milton Bradley years ago. Mm-hmm. But in about 2010, they relaunched My Little Pony, which became huge. It's, I think, about like $1 billion in sales last year. It has this very popular TV show with kids. And they started doing all this research into girls. So that was happening. Meanwhile, Barbie's sales have been seriously declining. I think they're down about 20% since 2012. And, you know, Barbie is the biggest moneymaker for Mattel and probably always will be. So Mattel really has to focus on that and how to bring Barbie back up. So Disney was noticing that and thinking maybe they won't get as much attention because Mattel has to focus on Barbie. And then Mattel actually released its own line of princess-themed dolls, which, if you know, unless you're a kid, you may not have heard of them, but they're called Ever After High. They have an accompanying online show. And they are the dolls. So a lot of original princesses like Cinderella and Snow White are in the public domain because they come from folktales. And the Ever After High dolls are supposed to be the teenage versions of those dolls. They don't have to pay licensing fees for them. And Disney didn't like that either. So then they went and talked to Hasbro and decided to give Hasbro the doll business, which is huge for them because they have not made a doll, you know, this big. I think Mattel made about $500 million a year off of them. So Hasbro, in theory, will make about that much as well, which they have not had in their girl business yet. So this is big.
Well, it is big, certainly, and I think it does speak to, it'll be interesting to see the direction that Hasbro takes it, because as you point out, they haven't really been in the girl-specific toys business. You know, they have a lot of very neutral toys, a lot of board games, Play-Doh, things like that, the very, very Nerf, things that are very neutral, some things that are more boy toys than girl toys, right? So it will be interesting to see how they take that that backlash into consideration and change that and run with that, and it will be very interesting. And so do you think there will still be all those licensed products out there of the combs and the lip balm and shoes and paint and all those things, or do you think that's going to kind of rejigger also?
No, I think that will definitely stay. I mean, there's a reason why the princesses is the second biggest after Mickey Mouse for Disney. It's because, you know, this is the thing that little girls buy. It's so popular that people talk about their kids going through the princess phase as if it's the stage of development. So, you know, if your daughter wants a room painted in princess pink and wants to buy the hairbrush and all this sort of stuff, and Disney is selling those just fine, those will stay. I think it's with the toys and the way that the characters are sort of positioned within the marketing, which may, I don't know about, you know, new hairbrushes coming out or something like that, but those will probably stay about the same. but it's in terms of the movies that they have coming out and the way that these dolls are going to be advertised towards girls. When Disney first created this line in 2001, and they lumped all these women together, mm-hmm. they made these marketing rules, like they can't look at each other, they can't act like they exist in the same storyline together, which made them look sort of just like models standing in a magazine where they're not actually doing anything. So I think when they reconfigure some of this and they create new designs for maybe new bed sheets or something like that, they may put them in more active poses or have them actually sort of participating in life rather than just standing there in a dress.
Than just standing there and looking pretty. It's like the Bechdel test for toys, really.
Exactly.
I love that. Well, thank you so much, Claire Sudduth from Bloomberg. Please, everybody, go to Bloomberg.com and look for this article that she wrote. It's called The $500 Million Battle Over Disney's Princesses. It gets into a lot of great detail, certainly more than we have time to get through today. But thank you so much for joining us, Claire.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good one. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news. And when we come back, we are talking about Big Pharmaceutical and that guy, Martin Shkreli, say it three times fast and it's almost impossible. Anyway, we'll be talking about him, the guy that we have all been watching fall from grace, when we come back on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch, wishing you all a happy and wonderful new year. And I hope it is a prosperous and wonderfully successful one for you all, indeed. Hey there, Rob Hart. I haven't officially wished you a happy new year yet.
Well, now that it's been officially wished, it's going to be a happy new year.
There you go. That's all it had to happen. We had to officially wish each other a happy new year.
We'll write it down. On January 2nd, 2016 at 12:33, Rob Hart and Amy Guth will both have happy new years.
I like it.
Happy's new year.
Happy's new years. What did you do to ring in the new year? Were you out here at the Chi-Town Rising or any of that?
I was in bed. I rung in the new year utilizing my best talent, which is sleeping.
I wish I had a little soundbite of that wonderful little from The Simpsons where Ralph Wiggum says, sleep, that's where I'm a Viking,
yes.
That would be the perfect moment for it. I never have The Simpsons quote I need when I need it, ever. Ah, oh, that's a shame.
That should be an app for 2016, either for broadcasters or in life. Just something that the moment you say, give me sleep, and all of a sudden, there's like 10 Simpsons quotes available to you right there.
Right, because there's that one comes up all the time, and the other one that comes up anytime anyone mentions burning or something tastes like something else, you say,
it tastes like burning.
That's the one you do.
Well, I saw Star Wars a couple of weeks ago, and the moment Chewbacca makes his appearance, I did want to say I bent my Wookiee.
Yeah, see, there's always a Simpsons for every occasion.
That's why the app needs to be made.
We
both developed this thing, and then boom, we're out of here. We're doing it because we love it.
I think we just figured out how to have a really good year. We're going to build this app and make millions.
Yes.
Let's go.
Done.
Suddenly.
And no one else can take this idea.
No, because we're not saying it in a public forum.
Right. No, nope. We've called it, we've claimed it, and there are no takebacks.
Meanwhile, producer Griffin is sitting there building it, taking it away from us. He's already bought the domain. It's already done. Damn you.
I'm back at 1 o'clock then.
That's right. Well, I just think it would be perfect because there's always a Simpsons-ism for every occasion, even in a business show. Even if. Well, there's lots of wonderful resolutions for the year ahead. And, you know, it seems like big businesses are counting on us to make those resolutions, to put our dollars behind those healthy choices, even if they are short-lived. It seems like ChicagoTribune.com, the business section, has a story all about companies that are working on the new year, new you, right? All of that. And they are exactly the ones you would guess. It was talking about where the companies that have big profits this time of year that do well. Weight Watchers, of course, is at the top of that list. Nutrisystem high on that list. You know, those are two that take some of the guesswork out of it. And there's so many people that want to lose weight and get in shape in the year ahead. So I've got to think that gyms have very good profit margins this time of year. And indeed, Lifetime Fitness is on that list of one of those businesses that is counting on us to have to have those healthy resolutions and do big things in the year ahead, or at least the first quarter of it. Usually. The other one is Nike. Nike's a big one. And I think all those fitness brands, there's so many other brands. Those are just the big bigs that are in, this time of year that are looking at us using our resolutions wisely, at least for a hot minute.
It's smart.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I were in the fitness industry in any way attached to any of that, I would certainly capitalize on that, too. I've got to think, too, things like the Container Store and places like that that are like, get organized. Do it. You know, I think it's got to extend so much beyond fitness into, because what are the big ones? Like, get organized.
Yeah.
Get in shape or lose weight.
That's the big one.
That's probably the big one that so many people have.
Maybe it's just me. I always want to read more, and it never happens, but I could see Kindle sales going up.
Yeah, yeah. Probably some stuff like, I'm trying to think what the dollar amount is behind it, but I think a lot of people do want to kind of challenge themselves to do something like try a new skill or, you know, so I got to think that like cooking classes or dance classes or things like that probably go up this time of year too.
Cooking big time. I have been noticing on Twitter a lot of angry fit people that actually go to the gym year-round.
Oh, God, you can't get a treadmill right now.
And you would be one of them.
I am one of those.
I sympathize more with the resolutioners that are going in for the first time in years.
No, you know what? I don't get angry about it. In fact, I've seen a lot of people trying to be out and running right now, and they're kind of like, I don't know why you would do that because the sidewalks aren't clear and you're going to wipe out and then you're going to break something and then you're never going to be running. But when I do see someone out trying, you know, they're power walking or they're running or something, I just like imagine a little heart going right to them. Good for you. You're out there trying, even though the weather is very, very cold. I don't like to run in cold weather, but I do.
Well, you're a little better about it than other gym goers, I think, because generally the sentiment getting is very, and I get it. Like, this is their place.
Yeah, I've been coming here all year, and all of a sudden I got to wait for a treadmill. Yeah, and I do feel that. Like, come on, I got to wait for a treadmill. But you know what? I go, okay, if this is what it takes to, you know, you do have to get in the habit of creating habits. You can't just start and it's a habit. You got to make yourself have that habit. So, if this means more people in the world, healthier, happier people, I can go work in the weight room for a minute, or I can go do abs first and then I can do cardio. Nobody will die if I don't do cardio first. So I try to give them a little bit of grace. At least I try.
I would like to look at the numbers for whatever the biggest gyms are, LA Fitness, Lifetime Fitness, Planet Fitness, from January to February. I'm sure those are accessible.
I'm sure they are. And you know,
maybe the drop off isn't that quick. It's probably slower.
I was going to say it's usually March, but I think it's twofold because I think part of it is people are flaking out on their resolutions. And then the other part of it is when it starts to warm up, more people are going outside.
I was surprised to see that Nike was on that list, too.
Well, I think that's kind of, you know, that's a company that people depend on of, you know, I'm going to go get some good gear and that's going to motivate me to work out. You know,
right.
And so they'll, in the big Nike store here on Michigan Avenue, they'll go in there and they'll get their good stuff and they'll get all outfitted. And, you know, I've always done that backwards. If every time I've had a fitness setback, like from an injury or something, it's really hard to come back from it.
Uh-huh.
You know, one had me completely sidelined for over a year. I could not even do anything. I was really hurt in a car accident. And that one was, I knew it was going to be so frustrating because right before that injury, I was running my fastest miles ever. I was in really good shape. And then suddenly, super sidelined, and I knew I was gonna have to start from zero. And so I was like, I'm not gonna start with the good fitness stuff, I'm gonna earn it. So I'm
gonna earn it.
Yes, I'm like, I'm gonna go to the gym and just the regular old stuff that I've had all along, the rattiest, you know, whatever workout clothes. And after, I'm gonna set a bunch of different milestones. And so this milestone will earn me a new pair of shoes or a new, you know, yoga pants or new whatever. So I did it that way, and that motivated me.
The way that we think about fitness could not be more different. I can't imagine being motivated by that.
Hey, whatever works.
Whatever works. Yeah, I don't know what it would be, but I do like that idea. Well, the thing is, even if you don't end up using your workout clothes year-round that you bought idealistically in January, I still think it would be worth it. It's just worth the feeling of buying that stuff and, like, the opportunity.
Sure.
Even if it goes wasted.
Yeah. And
it's still, you can enjoy that for a minute.
You have hope for a minute. Well,
it's buying that emotion for just one
definitely.
Second.
Definitely. And I think there is something to be said for having the right tools to do a task and dressing the part. I mean, I think that applies to the workplace. You feel better if you have on a nice suit or nice jacket or, you know, rather than, even if it's a very casual workplace, you go in ratty jeans, you're just not going to feel as leadershipy or on your A game as much as if you have on a nice suit. So I think that applies to fitness too.
I guess so, yeah.
I guess.
The numbers don't lie.
The numbers don't lie. And, you know, Nike seems like a big one. I think it would be interesting to look at. There have been a couple of web-based, not brick-and-mortar stores, particularly around workout clothes, yoga attire in particular. Fabletics has been a really interesting one all year because they came out of the gate. It's Kate Hudson, Goldie Hawn's daughter, you know, actress Kate Hudson. Yeah. It's her company. And she came out of the gate saying, in the marketing messages talking about the companies that were going to be nervous as a result of her company launching. And it's kind of this, it's like a subscription service to getting fitness attire. You kind of pick the, here's the stuff I do, and then they'll send you, you know, they'll pick out outfits for you and do that. It's a very different take on it. So I think that'll be, that'll be interesting to me. That's the next evolution of those like box subscriptions. There was like Stitch Fix, which I've used, which was you sign up, you tell them the kind of clothing you like, you give them your sizes, and a stylist just sends you stuff. Every month you get a box, and if you like it, you keep it. If you don't, you send it back. So it was kind of, it's, I think, the next evolution of that, because those boxes sort of had a little bit of criticism, and that I wanted, you know, a little more say in how I'm being dressed. And it's fun when they, you know, they all worked out.
I hadn't heard of that kind of service for clothes so much, but I have heard of it for like razors.
Yeah, the
shaving.
Shave of the Month Club is
and,
huge.
And food, also like snacks.
Yeah, there's
like
a few.
Nature Box, I think. Is that
Nature
what that
Box is? Nature Box is one. There's a, I can't think of the name of it. There's a great one for like cosmetics and skincare that people like. And then the alternative to that one, there was one that came out called Bro Box. And it's like men's toiletries, skincare, shaving, things like that.
All that stuff makes a little more sense to me because it will be gone.
You're going
to
use it.
Whereas I buy clothes, I'm wearing them for the next 20 years.
Right. Well, this, I thought Stitch Fix was a really interesting idea because it did, it really asked you some very specific questions, like what drives you crazy about clothes? And I said, well, I'm 5'10 and it's very difficult to find sleeves and pants long enough. And if the waist doesn't look right, it looks like a maternity top and most waists are not right. So I usually don't bother with the waistline. I just wear a t-shirt or something like that. So they really give you an opportunity to kind of just air your grievances in the spirit of Festivus and, you know, talk about here's what is a deal breaker to me on clothing. And they did a pretty good job of picking out things. Some of it was, I didn't think, let's say, age appropriate for me. I was like, you know, I would have loved that when I was about 16, but I'm more than double that now, thanks. So
interesting. Maybe that should be my New Year's resolution purchases, invest in dressing a little better.
That's a good one.
I could see that. I wonder if people make that resolution too. I don't know. Do you have any this year?
You know what? Mine's kind of hokey, but I have two. I bought this giant jar that is sitting on my kitchen counter. I put it on Instagram, this picture of it. And I have little pieces of paper that I bought, like little Post-its and stuff. And I'm writing things that are, I'm not great at counting my blessings and I'm not great at celebrating wins. And so I tend to get a win or accomplish something and then immediately I'm on to the next target and I need to do better at that. So I'm going to write at least one a day of here's a great thing that happened today. Maybe that's a conversation that was fun or nice or a win or an accomplishment, big or small, whatever. And I'm going to put at least one little piece of paper in the jar every day. And I'm going to listen to my gut more. That's my big resolution.
I love that. I think a lot of people could learn, enjoy your year more.
Enjoy the year more. And, I tend to be a little more, I tend to talk myself out of things that I know in my bones are right because I'm like, I need to listen to my brain here and do the data doesn't lie. But sometimes you're like, your gut knows it even when it doesn't make sense. And even in a business setting, you're like, I know I should do this, but the data says this, so I'll do that. And then it ends up being the wrong call.
Right.
So it's listen to my gut and celebrate the wins.
Well, be interested to see where you're at 1 year from now. If the gut failed you.
I know, if I'm just really doing badly.
Destitute.
Yeah, Guth was okay, and then she really went downhill after she started listening to her gut so much. That gut steered her wrong. All right, it's a Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to take a little bit of a break, and we'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us this very beautiful sunny day. It's cold out there, but it is so lovely and the sun is gorgeous and people are so smiley walking by the window here on Michigan Avenue from the Allstate Showcase Studio. All right, my friends, we have so many things still to talk about and the hour always goes so fast, but indeed we are joined now by Paul Barrett, who is our senior writer at Bloomberg, to talk about this look that we have gotten lately into the big pharmaceutical industry, because we've certainly seen a very different and interesting side of it lately with the story that we've all been following, this character, this very interesting pharmaceutical CEO, Martin Shkreli, who we have watched fall from grace and really be a very interesting and entertaining character. And it's really given us a very interesting look into this industry. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, so talk us through this a little bit, because, you know, it seems like he surely cannot be the first or the last to have, you know, such interesting behavior and make such very questionable choices in the pharmaceutical world. And yet he has certainly been singled out a bit just by his own choices and some of the very interesting things that he will become known for.
Right. Well, Martin Shkreli is certainly an extreme case. But as I've written, he's not unique in what he's done. So let's sort of unwind the story. There really are two narrative lines here. One involves Shkreli's dealings with his investors, and it's that has gotten him in trouble with the law. He has been criminally indicted for allegedly using the assets, the stock and cash from one of his biotech companies, a company called Retrofin, to pay off unhappy investors who lost money in hedge funds that he had set up earlier. So that's the reason why he's looking at potential prison time, and it's important to emphasize that he claims that he's completely innocent, and we can talk more about those charges if you'd like.
And his
His
attorneys have certainly taken issue. I think the word Ponzi scheme got thrown out really quickly as those accusations surfaced, and his attorneys quickly pushed back and said, no, very different situation. In fact, you know, they're saying, you know, in this case, people did actually make money. They weren't just kind of left out to dry. It's different. I mean, they were semantics indeed, but they were very quick to push back on that word.
That is true. And it's also true that unlike a classic Ponzi scheme, he was actually setting up companies that did have real revenue and value in the stock market and so forth. The reason he's more broadly known and why he was provoking controversy even before the FBI showed up at his house one morning is that his basic business strategy in running two different small biotech companies was to take relatively obscure old medications and repurpose them for new applications and very sharply increase their prices. And it's this drug pricing strategy which made him very controversial. He got a lot of attention for it, and rather than back down, he was defiant and said that, no, he was doing this so that he would be able to raise money for research and development. But he took a lot of criticism from patient advocates who said that this kind of behavior, this drastic increase in pricing, is something that's rampant throughout the drug industry. And it's that he's become sort of the poster boy for this tendency within the pharmaceutical business.
Right, and it certainly seemed like it sparked a lot of conversations about drug pricing, because when he first adjusted the cost of Daraprim to be from $13.50 a pill to $750 a pill, there were a lot of stories and a lot of in-depth reports about just what that meant and just what all that would entail, and even looking in some other markets, I think there was a story about how in Brazil that very same pill was something like $2 a pill as opposed to the $13.50 that it was here. And I think it got a lot of people thinking in a much more meaningful and deeper way about pharmaceutical pricing and how that really, you know, I think it made a lot of people question it. Because before that, I think where we saw it was when we go to get a prescription, we go, oh my gosh, that's so expensive. Thank God I have insurance. Or, oh my gosh, I don't have insurance, or my insurance doesn't cover this, or whatever. And that's, we felt it very personally. But this seems like it really brought that into a mainstream conversation when we saw this very extreme example.
That's right, and I think the international comparison is apt because it's by making those international comparisons, how much a drug costs in the United States versus how much the identical drug made by the same company can be obtained for abroad, that you begin to see just how expensive drugs have become in the U.S. Bloomberg has done analysis responding to the drug industry's contention that those comparisons are often unfair because they don't take into account discounts that are available in this country. Well, at Bloomberg, we did some very thorough analysis that factored in the discounts and found that for a wide range of widely prescribed prescription drugs, the prices were still twice as high or more in this country than they were in Canada or various European countries. So I think people are beginning to realize just how great the discrepancy is, and realize that in a very practical way, drug R&D worldwide is being subsidized by American consumers, because we're just paying a lot more for these drugs in this country because we have a tradition and in some cases actual statutes that prevent the kind of government regulation of drug prices that's quite common in other developed countries.
That is really so very interesting, and that's an interesting point to consider, that in fact we are part of the reason why Daraprim perhaps is $2 in Brazil and things like that. And yeah. So what, you know, why, I mean, in its simplest form, why is it that we tolerate it? Is it happening because we tolerate it? And what do we do about it?
Well, it's really both of those things. But we have a free market tradition in the United States. That generally weighs against government regulation of prices, not just of drugs, but of other products as well. And that tradition does not exist in, for example, most European countries or in Canada, where the governments of those countries basically require drug companies to bring the prices of various pharmaceuticals down, particularly over time. The bias against that type of government regulation is so strong in the United States that the largest customer in the drug marketplace, namely the government-backed Medicare program for older people, is banned by statute from negotiating drug prices with pharmaceutical companies. Hmm. So here's a potential customer that, by dint of its volume purchase of drugs, could have tremendous influence and could push back against pharmaceutical companies and push the prices down. And Congress has literally banned the Medicare program from doing so. So what could we do about it? Well, you could elect people to Congress and elect someone to the White House who would undo that restriction. That would be one step toward allowing the government, through the form of the Medicare program, to lower drug prices. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, you could have more thoroughgoing regulation of prices. But as I say, the pharmaceutical industry is powerful, has skillful, well-paid lobbyists. And more broadly, we have a tradition in this country of seeing the marketplace as unregulated as opposed to controlled by the government.
Indeed. And as you point out in this story, everybody go to Bloomberg.com and check this story out by Paul Barrett that we have on the phone here with us. There's some really interesting examples that you point out. There's a multiple sclerosis drug that went from about $1,200 a vial to more than $29,000 a vial when prices were raised on that one. And then two relatively common heart drugs that went from 212% markup to 525% respectively. And a tuberculosis treatment that went from $20 a pill to $360 a pill. These are remarkable changes. Those are significant and changes most people cannot afford. Most households cannot tolerate any, even with a, you know, insurance absorbing part of that. It's just an unbelievable amount of money, especially in my mind, it's so problematic when it's indeed a life-saving drug, when it's something so essential that would improve the quality of someone's life, when it would keep them alive. That's when it seems the most problematic to me, certainly.
Right, and I think this is something that we're going to see debated in the upcoming presidential election, because Hillary Clinton, the likely Democratic candidate, has already identified mm-hmm. pharmaceutical prices as being one of the issues she's going to emphasize. And in fact, she has specifically referred to Martin Shkreli as being kind of a villain and the sort of representative of a tendency towards these very, very sharp price increases that she hasn't been that specific yet, intends to counteract. So that brings us a full circle in this conversation back to this unusual character, Martin Shkreli.
Definitely. He is a very unusual character, but he has sparked a lot of conversation around a very, very important topic. Paul Barrett, thanks so much for joining us today on The Business Lunch.
My pleasure.
All right, have a good one. All right, you can read all about all the work that he's doing around this topic and other topics at Bloomberg.com. Look for this story. It's called Shkreli Wasn't the First to Hike Drug Prices, and He Won't Be the Last. That's on Bloomberg.com by our new friend, Paul Barrett. All right, we're going to take a quick break and get you news and all that good stuff here in just a bit on 720 WGN.